And so when it comes to the reaction of paramilitary groups that are targeted in Syria or in Iraq, the distinction might be made legally. The distinction might be made to the U.S. It might even be made to Prime Minister Khaldemi's office. But at the end of the day, it's going to amount to a likelihood of retaliation on the U.S. within Iraqi territory. Just because it's happening in Abu Kamal, that right across from, you know, Qa'im in Iraq, doesn't mean that the response to it won't happen in Iraq.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 1st, 2021. The United States hit targets in Syria associated with two Iraqi militias last week in the first military operations of the Biden administration. We thought it would be a good opportunity to catch up on the situation on the ground in Iraq, where politics are, as always, wild and woolly and super, super complicated. Joining me on Lawfare Live before a live audience were Lawfare's senior editor, Scott Anderson, who of course served in Iraq in the embassy there, as well as Marcin Al-Shamari, a postdoctoral fellow at the Brookings Institution's Foreign Policy Program and an expert in domestic Iraqi politics. We talked about who the groups are that the U.S. attacked. We talked about the constellation of forces in the current Iraqi government. We talked about the legal authority for the attack, and we talked about where Iraqi politics go from here. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 1st, your questions on Iraq. Scott, get us started. There were, conveniently for the relevance of this discussion today, there were some airstrikes in Syria yesterday from the United States, the first military actions of the Biden administration. What do we know about them? And what do we know about their purpose, their targets, and why this happened yesterday?
Sure. It's very polite of the Biden administration to wait to take their first military action until after I was off paternity leave, so I can come talk about it with you guys and on Lawfare, which is good. I would be heartbroken otherwise. What we saw happen last night, Eastern Coast time, I should say, appears to have been airstrike against a small, relatively constrained number of targets in eastern Syria associated with, according to the DOD statement, Kitab Hezbollah, which is a fairly well-known, fairly large and influential militia or popular mobilization force in Iraq associated with Iran and Shia and kind of Shia population and Iranian support with that group, longstanding ties. And also Kitab Sayyid al-Shahada, which I'm probably mispronouncing slightly, but that's my I think I'm doing that about right, which is a less well-known, less prominent, unless you, I think it's a newer arrival on the scene that I'm less familiar with. Is it interesting that it was these two groups that got attributed to it? If you've been following a lot of the external expert, a lot of the external speculation was that actually at least the Erbil attack was attributing it to Asad al-Haq, another one of these militia groups with Iranian ties. That is something of a rival in many ways to Kitab Hezbollah and some of these other groups, and that has been engaged in some of their own internecine violence within Iraq. But the statement from DOD would seem pretty clear that, in fact, these groups are the ones to which they are attributing, in coordination with Iraqi officials, the attacks that have occurred over the last few weeks in Erbil, at Balad Air Base outside of Baghdad and in the Green Zone, former Green Zone or International Zone in Baghdad, where the U.S. Embassy is located. So it's notable from that regard about who the target was. The other big notable factor about it, I would say, is that this took place in Syria, not in Iraq. The Trump administration really routinely pursued airstrikes against these militia groups in both countries. We saw in December 2019 kind of that kicked off the U.S. military response led by the Trump administration attacks against Kitab Hezbollah in Syria and in different locations in Iraq. But the fact that they're only pursuing this in Syria, I think, is very notable. And I think is an indicator of kind of the broader shift within the Biden administration towards what I see as a much more sustainable and effective Iraq policy, which is one that's much more intent on working with Iraqi government and Iraqi officials, at least within a scope with which they're more comfortable than the Trump administration, which was much more adversarial, much more willing to do things openly in contrary to what the stated preference of Iraqi officials was.
I'm going to follow up quickly on that with one question, Scott. Do you have any sense of why now? How much of this is a target of opportunity presented itself? How much of this is, you know, an effort to send a message to the Iranians that, you know, yes, there's things we're going to talk about, but there's not a, you know, no slackening in will? How much of this is just, well, we're a month into a new administration, got to show the world that you're willing to use military force? Do we have any sense of why this happened yesterday?
I don't think we have a clear sense, but I have some educated guesses that I would be willing to throw out there. You know, we have seen, again, the Biden administration very clearly say in response to these prior three attacks, look, we are waiting and working with Iraqi officials to determine attribution. Prior to the set of strikes, they were not willing to attribute them to anyone, even though, again, we had a lot of chatter and kind of the external expert sphere willing to do that, which I think indicated, again, that they were really trying to work with the Iraqis on a response that they were going to be comfortable with, or at least more comfortable with than some alternatives. And so I suspect that's why this happened now. It's a combination of the United States engaging with Iraqi counterparts diplomatically, putting pressure on them to say, well, what sort of, we're going to have to do some sort of response, what will it have to be? And then domestic pressure building, frankly, on the U.S. side for feeling some sort of response. There is always a domestic pressure to respond to acts of violence with violence. I actually think it's really unfortunate. It's often ill-considered. It could lead to some really bad policymaking, but it's real, especially so early in the administration, especially when the Biden administration is under pressure domestically for trying to re-engage with the Iranians and being cast as looking weak in regards to the Iranians. And so they're going to face a lot of domestic political pressures to respond in some way. And I think this was kind of the intersection of those supply and demand curves, what the Iraqis were willing to tolerate and what the domestic political situation the Biden administration demanded. As for it being a target of opportunity, I kind of highly doubt it. These were border control points for an established supply route used by these militia groups, meaning like they've been sitting there for a while. There's no indication these were newly established. And so I kind of doubt that this was, you know, a unique opportunity. I think they probably had this on a target list from the outset and, again, settled on it because the Iraqis were willing to say, we're at least not going to publicly object to this. It's taking place in Syria, not in Iraq. It actually probably does diminish the ability of these groups to operate, probably more in Syria than Iraq, but who knows, could be both. Supplies kind of go both directions at various points, depending on what exactly you're talking about, what avenue Iran is using to bring supplies in. And so, you know, again, I think it's much more about what the political dynamics were willing to accommodate and allow.
Okay, Marcin, let's start with how much of what Scott said just now do you disagree with? And what did he leave out that's worth adding?
Less about disagreement, more about adding in the Iraqi side of things. So in terms of what I've seen from the Iraqi side, just a few minutes ago, I was reading that the Ministry of Defense had released a statement saying that they didn't, that the reaction to the U.S. saying that this was done, you know, with Iraqi knowledge, they were confused about it. And so that makes complete sense for them to do that. I mean, the Iraqi state is composed of so many actors. Prime Minister Khadami might be, you know, an American ally in support of the United States, but his hands are tied in terms of other actors in the government having different allegiances and feeling differently about it. And he has to be smart and pragmatic about the way he does things. So from the Iraqi side, you're not going to get a confirmation of it being anything that was orchestrated together or informed of or anything like that. But that's perfectly normal. The one thing that I also wanted to add from the American side that perhaps isn't new, but is new in the longer trajectory, is there's a shift from, and I really want this shift to occur even more, from a broad generalization of the popular mobilization forces as this big monolithic umbrella that is just the source of all evil, to actually targeting or thinking about breaking it apart into specific groups and thinking about, you know, what are the roles of each of these groups? Are they part of the Iraqi government? Are they individual actors? What are their ties? And I think that would go a long way towards easing tensions between the Iraqi state at large and the United States. And then the final point I would say from the Iraqi side that I've also seen, I saw in an article in AP and then again in Iraqi media, is that the number of deaths is still being, you know, was said by from the militia side to be one, and then from the U.S. side to be 22 people who were killed. So that's still something that is being reported on differently. No disagreement, just addition.
And so what do you, how would you characterize the two groups in question? I mean, one of which is much significantly better known than the other, but for those members of the audience who don't know either, just walk us through who these militias are and why the U.S. would want to be targeting them.
I mean, as Scott said, Kata'ib Hezbollah is a well-known paramilitary group and member of the PMF. They have strong political factions. Very long ago, they split off from, or their leader split off from the Sadrist movement, which is a very well-known movement in Iraq that also has their own paramilitary group. It is more of a social movement. And they have strong ties to Iran that are well-known. They have been implicated in both when during the Iraqi protests, there was this demonstration near the embassy, near the American embassy. Oh, I'm sorry. I said there was a Sadrist movement. I confused them with another militia. They're not actually part of it. I confused them with Asad Bahad al-Haq. But they have been implicated in, you know, previous rocket attacks against the American embassy. And so they've identified as a group. And like I said before, I do like that there is a closer identification of who these groups are. And clearly they do operate in Syria. And they are one of the lines from Iran to Syria. And in case I confuse anyone in the audience, I had them confused with another group with similar initials that was part of the Sadrist movement.
And what about the other group that was targeted? Do we know anything about them?
I know maybe Scott knows more than me. I haven't heard much about them other than, you know, I've heard of them on occasion, but I can't really tie them to any particular event. I will say, though, when it comes to the groups that have been continuously named in attacks in Erbil, for example, and you know, the recent attacks on U.S. and Iraq, those groups tend to have names that no one really has heard of before. And a lot of people are just usually just say that this is just a way for them to cover up their direct involvement. So for larger groups to mask their involvement by creating these smaller groups with, you know, very flashy names that tend to disappear after one attack. But that's not the case for the two groups that were attacked in Syria.
Yeah, the as far as I know, this is very limited based off of my Googling earlier, but because I wasn't familiar with the group off the top of my head earlier. Kataib Sayyid al-Shahada is associated with the Badr organization, which is another one of a group that is a political movement, social movement, part of kind of the Shia governing coalition. And Badr organization also has a variety of kind of like militant parts as well as non-militant parts as well. I think it's kind of a splinter group from them. I don't believe it actually is seen as operating very closely, but has been primarily active in Syria, more so than Iraq. So that's my understanding, although I would welcome if anybody has better information to intercede.
Scott, we have not yet gotten the War Powers report that we would normally expect within 48 hours of such a strike, but we kind of know what it's going to say, right? What's the legal theory in which the U.S. is operating when it does this sort of thing?
So I think we have a good idea of the international, and then we have a good idea of two possibilities for the domestic, but it's actually kind of an interesting question as to which way the Biden administration will go. On an international law plane, the United States has fairly broad views compared to the rest of the international community, not all the rest, but substantial parts of the international community and the International Court of Justice, most notably, about what is appropriate self-defense. Essentially, they say, look, if you're targeted by an actor, a state can respond in self-defense in a way that's necessary to prevent a recurrence of attacks. It doesn't have to be sort of one-to-one in terms of an immediate response just to stop an immediate attack. Instead, you can actually respond and try and hinder a hostile actor's ability to respond to you. And this seems to fit pretty comfortably in that. The fact that this took place in Syria also kind of makes it a little easier legally, international law-wise. For the attack taking place in Iraq, a big problem with them was that you're not supposed to take military action against third parties in a state without its permission or consent. The United States has advanced a theory. It's gotten some acceptance, although it's controversial in other circles, but some acceptance, at least with major military allies, that where a state is unable or unwilling to contain a threat posed by a third party within its borders, another state can act against that entity with its own self-defense. And that's likely what we're seeing happening here. The United States has already made that determination in regards to Syria, meaning the unable or unwilling determination. Certainly in regard to ISIS, that dates all the way back to the Obama administration. Again, the Trump administration took actions like this against Shia militias in Syria as well. I'm not aware of them having said it expressly, although they might have, but I suspect unable or willing fits into that as well. Domestically, this is the sort of thing that, again, fits pretty comfortably with Article 2 self-defense concepts advanced by the executive branch, which are fairly expansive, and there's lots of ways to criticize them, some of which I agree with, but nonetheless, it's pretty well-established executive branch views. But the real question here is whether that's actually what the Biden administration will rely on. The Trump administration actually argued that the authorizations for use of military force statutes relating both to counter ISIS mission and to Iraq, meaning the 2001-2002 AUMS, not only authorize direct military action in relation to those objectives, but also authorize U.S. troops to respond in self-defense when they were engaged in those missions, but came under attack by a third entity. And the Trump administration went even further, all this isn't implicated here, to say, and we can respond to allies of ours in our primary mission when they come under attack by third parties. So this is a collective self-defense concept, but again, it also applies to kind of individual self-defense that we hear talked a lot about with the Trump administration. It's one of their genuine innovations in kind of the AUMF war power space. So it'll be interesting to see whether the Biden administration embraces that interpretation or not. If we don't get a war powers report in 48 hours, that will mean that they did accept that interpretation, because that means that they are saying it's statutorily authorized, so we're not obligated to provide a 48 hours war powers report. I think we almost certainly will, because the Biden administration has made such a big deal about war powers transparency during the campaign and in criticizing the Trump campaign, a Trump administration, I should say. So I strongly suspect we're going to get a 48 hours report, but we don't know whether it'll just limit itself to Article 2, just limit itself to these AUMF arguments, or do both. I suspect they're going to retain strategic flexibility just because that's the way executive branch lawyers approach this thing. But we will wait and see.
Yeah, so I'm not a legal expert by any means, but there's one issue that needs to be stated, is that the way that this is happening right now, whether or in Iraq or in Syria, is long-term very problematic, because the ideal solution is for Iraq to be a strong state that can take care of its own internal security and that can have a monopoly on security internally by itself. And so when it comes to the reaction of paramilitary groups that are targeted in Syria or in Iraq, the distinction might be made legally. The distinction might be made to the U.S. It might even be made to Prime Minister Khaldemi's office. But at the end of the day, it's going to amount to a likelihood of retaliation on the U.S. within Iraqi territory. Just because it's happening in Abu Kamal, that right across from, you know, Qa'im in Iraq, doesn't mean that the response to it won't happen in Iraq. And so in that way, I think, like I said, I'm not well versed in the legality of it at all, but it almost amounts to being besides the point when it comes to the repercussions that are going to happen and the likely outcome or reaction by these groups is, you know, just because the U.S. does something in Syria doesn't mean that the reaction will continue to, you know, will remain in Syria.
I completely agree with that. The longer we go without clarifying the legal authority in a fashion that looks something like the region, the more divorced the law becomes from the day-to-day reality of what the U.S. could or should be doing or not doing. The floor is yours.
Hey, all. And Ben, I gotta say that I'm honored to converse with an esteemed member of the legal intelligentsia.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, so what progress has been made to rebuild and upgrade Iraqi infrastructure? And is the Iraqi government at present able to provide its citizens with electricity, water, and other basic services? Thanks.
This actually ties quite well to the regional implications as well. So infrastructurally, particularly when it comes to electricity, we're not doing well. I mean, I am in Baghdad right now, and there's a lot of power outages. And one of the reasons this is happening is because Iraq is being caught up between Iran and the U.S. again, where Iraq actually needs to import gas from Iran and has been unable to pay Iran because of U.S. pressures and sanctions. And so putting Iraq in a really hard place where it hasn't been able to provide electricity as much as it needs to for its citizens. And as you can see in Iraqi contemporary history, every time there is an electricity shortage, significant one, oftentimes you get protests as a result. And it's deeply destabilizing for the state. So this is in one of the avenues that I particularly think there should be more diplomacy and more leeway for Iraq, because this is quite difficult for the average Iraqi. And, you know, it's a problem that the Iraqi government hasn't developed the capacity in the past two decades to be able to provide this. But at the same time, it remains that the impact of it is going on to the average Iraqi citizen.
Given the level of insurgency and societal upset in Iraq, is it realistic to expect the U.S. will draw down or withdraw troops in the foreseeable future? Marcin, why don't you get us started with that? And Scott, chime in anytime when she's done.
I'll preface it by saying that there isn't that much U.S. presence. There's 2,500 troops in an advisory role in Iraq, so there isn't much to begin with. And in addition to that, talking about societal cleavages or upheavals, I think it's very easy to view that from the outside and think that Iraqi society is, you know, going through this very tough moment with a lot of tension. But actually, the tension is less about politics and more about economics. We've just had to devalue the dinar, which has been relatively stable for years. I mean, that was one of the this was the first time that it's been devalued in a long time. And it's really affected the public sector a lot. You know, employees, their salaries, the value of them went down. And people are very distraught and concerned about this. There is also a lot of poverty in Iraq. So I think the main concern that the average Iraqi citizen has right now genuinely isn't about these larger international issues or these larger cleavages of identity and religion and the like that might appear from the outside, but honestly about how the economic crisis, how the COVID crisis, which compounded the economic crisis, has made the situation very difficult for the average citizen.
I agree with everything I think Marcin just said, but I want to elaborate a little bit on some of the, I think, calculus that goes into U.S. troop presence and a drawdown or something to that effect. You know, obviously, U.S. troop presence and coalition troop presence, you know, U.S. troops aren't the only ones in Iraq, although I think they're pretty much the lion's share of it at this point. I actually don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head of coalition forces, you know, have come under increased pressure, particularly over the last 18 months, 2 years, from these sorts of rocket attacks. That sort of threat is not entirely new for U.S. military presence. Rocket attacks were relatively regular incidents up through 2011, particularly towards the end of 2011, even when I was in Iraq, 2012, 2013, through 2014, actually, you know, a periodic possibility, although usually less sophisticated types of rockets and weapons that were being used because Iran at that time was not actively supporting that sort of activity and providing those sorts of supplies, as far as I, that's my speculation, at least. So there are ways to work around that. It is a real constraint on how these forces can operate and the diplomatic presence. It means that you can't leave your diplomatic compounds without, you know, serious hardened caravans and convoys. You know, when I would go out and engage diplomatic allies outside of counterparts, I should say, outside of the international zone, the kind of secure area, I would have to go in full body armor, which is a real thing when you're a lawyer and you're in a suit and you got a body armor over it. But it's just, you know, the way you have to do business there. Some of that is it gets extremely hot. Some of that is, you know, the risk tolerance that the United States has for this sort of thing. It has gotten lower, particularly since Benghazi, but to some extent with good reason. In some ways, I think maybe overly conservative. But in an environment like Baghdad is today, where you do have these militias that are active and very hostile, I think a lot of it is actually quite warranted, probably. But it does make it really harder to do the job. What we've seen instead, you know, U.S. forces do is button down and contain themselves in hardened areas. And we also have seen them streamline and reduce their presence in part in response to Iraqi pressures as a result of the kind of outrage over the U.S. military response under the Trump administration, where they're on a couple of hardened spots, often co-located with Iraqi forces, run and secured in substantial part by Iraqi forces, although there's usually a separate internal U.S. security kind of perimeter. And that's where they're doing a lot of their training and equipment missions. And there's a lot they can do there. So, you know, there's a threat levels can increase substantially in different parts of Iraq without necessarily impacting those sorts of missions, so long as you can maintain those sites. Rockets are like the one big way thing you have to be worried about coming into those sites. But again, you know, you can harden them pretty substantially. We saw, you know, a U.S. airbase or U.S. forces at an airbase survive a pretty intense array of Iranian rockets after the Soleimani strike without zero fatalities, lots of health consequences that should be taken seriously, but still zero fatalities. There are ways to harden those sites and mitigate a lot of those risks. You can never eliminate it entirely. And that is just a reality the United States and coalition partners have to live with if they're going to work in Iraq with the Iraqis. You know, I think a lot of Americans who have worked in Iraq and worked with Iraqis tend to think it's worth it because there are good allies there, people who seriously want to build a stronger country in a way that will serve a lot of U.S. strategic interests in the region, and that, you know, some risk tolerance is just a necessary part of the mission, and that, you know, taking steps like striking out with violence anytime you come under sort of threat or you take these sorts of hits often is counterproductive because it just increases and creates more political space for more violence against U.S. and coalition targets, but it's kind of unavoidable. That said, I do think more and more coalition partners are willing to accept some level of that risk. We've seen that recently with the announcement that NATO is seeking to expand its presence in Iraq from a current level of 500, which is actually bigger than I realized, much bigger than when I was in Iraq, to 4,000, a really substantial increase there that is going to be doing similar sort of training missions for the Iraqi military, Iraqi security forces, in hopes of, again, bolstering them so that they can have more authority and have more ability to operate domestically and, frankly, provide a counterbalance more effectively to Iran-backed militias, and frankly, to some extent, to Iran itself. You know, knowing that Iraq has its own strong military gives it a little bit more political space to push back against Iran diplomatically when Iran tries to run roughshod over it, which is what Iran really has been doing for the last several years, I think by most accounts. Marcin, you may disagree with that, and you should feel free, but that's my sense of it from afar.
I mean, I was just going to add that on Wednesday, we had President Barham Saleh at Brookings, who was asked a similar question about what the ideal is for Iraqis. And he said, you know, for Iraqis and for Americans, I think we both would prefer having no American presence. But he mentioned that we're still in the fight against ISIS in Iraq. But he is particularly, and I agree with him on this, interested in improving the capacity of the Iraqi army through NATO. So I think his view really represents what a lot of people think and agree with.
That's great.
So since we're having this discussion on the heels of the U.S. strike, do we expect that Iraq will continue to be a site of continuing proxy conflict between Iran and the United States? And what do we know about Iran's current intentions with respect to Iraq? Marcin, what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are pretty much similar to what I said earlier. So long as the United States and Iran continue to have their problems and their disputes, there's a very strong likelihood that they will be carried out on Iraqi soil from both sides. And
why is that? I mean, is it just because it's a convenient location for, I mean, why is it desirable from the Iranian side to use Iraq as a battlefield and from the U.S. side to do that? Why not do it more directly?
I mean, the short answer to that is that Iraq is enough of a weak state that it can be used for these purposes by both sides. For the Iranians, I mean, for both the U.S. and Iran, I definitely don't advocate for violence in any form, and I wish they would just pursue diplomacy. But the instance of this attack or any attack being on their soil, Iranian or American, really means an escalation into an all-out war. And perhaps it doesn't. I mean, I'm not sure. I can't foresee that. But it would entail a much bigger action than doing it in Iraq. Unfortunately, they have this option of playing things out on a territory that's not theirs and with a government that is divided and not strong enough to really respond to it. And unfortunately, the Iraqi government is unable to respond, not just to the, you know, predations on its territory. You know, they put out statements about Iraqi sovereignty being infringed on. But even when I was talking about the electricity and the gas thing, it's like it's really hard to take a position for them. It's just a very weak state, which is a natural consequence of going through the transition from authoritarianism to trying to achieve a democracy. But that's the short answer.
I agree with that, but I want to add one part of it that I think Americans lose sight of that I think is really important to understand, which is that the United States and Iran just do not operate on the same with the same political opportunity space in Iraq as each other. And that really shapes how they respond and should in a way that
I think. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean is that, you know, the United States, when it engages in lots of activities in Iraq, particularly military activity, though, it is still doing so in the shadow of the 2003 invasion and occupation. You know, U.S. military action is inherently controversial and not without reason, because Iraqis lived through a whole lot that the United States did badly and did poorly in Iraq. Although often, you know, there is a lot more made about U.S. military action than is warranted. These are narratives that are seized upon by U.S. rivals and played up domestically to make it harder the United States to do things in Iraq deliberately. But nonetheless, there is some seed of discontent there that you can understand, I think, sympathize with. Iranians, by contrast, you know, Iran and Iraq have deep historical, cultural, economic, every imagined sort of ties, as you would expect from two nations that border each other and have existed with, you know, people shifting back and forth between them for centuries. You know, Iran has the ability to operate through proxies because it has cultural historical ties, including in many cases, you know, providing a home for many Iraqi leaders who were in exile during the Hussein era, as well as religious leaders and other cultural leaders, not just political leaders. And that gives them a base of support to operate within Iraq that the United States can never really hope to rival and shouldn't try to. And it just gives a degree of, you know, relationship that is always going to exist between Iraq and Iran. And trying to disrupt that or pretend otherwise is really just misguided. There's always going to be close relationships there, as you would expect. It's like be trying to tell Canada and the United States that you guys need to sever ties. It's just never going to happen. In that sense, it's a great terrain for Iran to operate, because Iran can do a lot through proxies, I should note, almost always. Iran can do a lot without triggering the same domestic response that the United States will, with much less military action, because those relationships are just so different. And it means that, you know, when Iran, you know, if you see an Iran-backed militia launch a rocket at an airbase, the United States responds, perhaps even in perfect proportionality, one for one, they're not going to be seen the same way. The United States response is going to be received a lot less, more negatively by a good part of the Iraqi voting public, and that's going to be translated to its political leaders. It's just a political reality the United States really needs to wrap its head around and deal with and accept if they're going to keep pursuing a mission in Iraq, which again, I think is a good mission, both for Iraqis and for the broader regional stability and for the United States. But, you know, you see too many calls of people saying, oh, we've got to respond to strength with strength. Why don't the Iraqis step in and stop, you know, stop these attacks? Why don't we see the same sort of outrage? There's plenty of Iraqi outrage over the Iranian-backed militias and a lot of their actions, but it just is not happening on the same political terrain. The one other point I would just note is Iraq is also just the best field of opportunity for Iran. There are no other places where Iran, of the numerous places where Iran does have the ability to act through proxies in the region and in the world, Iraq is the only one with the scale of U.S. presence, military and diplomatic. You think of like Lebanon. Yeah, U.S. has an embassy there. They have substantial, but it's a very hardened embassy, limited personnel, very limited military mission, which is kind of like engaging with Lebanese army. Just not the same. The political situation is very constraining there as well. So it's just not the same opportunities like you see in Iraq. A lot of that is because of Iraq, a weak state, but there are also just underlying disparities in the context in which both the states are acting that feed to that dynamic.
Yeah, I agree. The largest embassy in the world in Baghdad, and then no embassy in Damascus. So that makes sense from a pragmatic perspective.
With a question that follows very logically from the discussion we've just been having.
Okay, so I'll just begin with the first one, and if some other questioner comes abroad, and you can switch to him, but or her. So, what's the basic power dynamic within the Iraqi government at present?
Yeah. So, Marcin, with all of this as prelude, you started by saying, hey, the Iraqi government has many factions, and even an understanding with the prime minister is not an understanding with Iraq. How non-unitary is the Iraqi state at this point?
It's as non-unitary as you can expect a parliamentary system to be, and then some. But the non-unitary aspect of it is almost something that you can expect similar patterns of in election cycles to happen. By that, I mean, you know, that you have the same set of actors, the same set of parties, but with oftentimes shifting alliances and slightly changing coalitions. But at the end of the day, it's usually the same groups or the same political parties who end up occupying the Iraqi parliament. With what's, I would say, is a little bit different that happened in the last election cycle and then post-protests, is the last election cycle really brought the Sadrists into the Iraqi government, more so into the parliament, more so than they had before. And it really alarmed everyone when they had gotten so many seats in parliament. And a lot of people have concerns that this is going to get more in the next electoral cycle. But just as a general response to that query that I always get about them, they're not really likely to get any more because their foundation is pretty much set. And that's the case with a lot of political parties in Iraq as well. Their foundation, the voting base for them, is pretty set. And so when you have things like electoral boycott, you end up really getting the same people over and over again because their supporters come out and vote. And when you actually have more voting, then you start to get a little bit more variation in the Iraqi government. In terms of their internal dynamics that have, you know, impact on how they react to whatever happens between the U.S. and Iran, the prime minister and a lot of people affiliated and associated with him have a very clear pro-American stance. And, you know, the U.S. has been in support of him for prime minister for a while, even before the protests. But there are equally figures in the Iraqi government, you know, who hold a lot of authority in parliament, who hold authority in ministries, who don't feel like an alliance with the United States or a strong relationship with it is best. And so it forces him, and conversely, if they were in power and he was in a different position, it forces them to not be able to really pick a side and stick to it. And it doesn't really help Khaldemi, although this is going a little bit off your question, that during the previous administration, he was quite publicly punished, and the threat of closing down the embassy was something that looked particularly bad when you have an ambassador, or sorry, a prime minister who is associated with the U.S., who is supportive of the U.S. in power. It looked particularly bad when his allies threatened him with a threat that we hadn't heard in a while. And I mean, the general rule for a successful prime minister in Iraq is not to really pick a side. The previous prime minister tried to pick the Iranian side, and that didn't end up well for him. And as we see from Khaldemi's case, he's trying to pick the American side, and that doesn't look like it's going to end well for him either. I don't know if that answered your question, but I tried to hit on a lot of points that people are genuinely interested in, and try to cover the fact that Iraq's political class changes in elections a bit.
I think that's great and a really useful overview. I think the key points, at least from a U.S. policy perspective, which is I know that's not the only perspective to talk about, and probably one of the less valuable ones, but it's the one I know the most. So I'll weigh in there, is that there's a surprising durability of tacit support for U.S. military cooperation. Khaldemi's been most outspoken about it, but we saw Adel Abdelmahdi, who was the, I think, caretaker prime minister at the time of the Soleimani strike, was kind of the first one where you saw him issue statements saying, oh, United States needs to sort of restructuring. You saw a parliamentary vote saying U.S. should start withdrawing its troops, but that was treated as non-binding for reasons I'm not entirely sure clear on the legality of. But, you know, kind of kept kicking the can down the road, creating opportunities for the United States to continue sort of military engagement there. And so there is this sort of like interesting wellspring of support, primarily really among Iraqi elites. I think the Iraqi leadership, particularly the security establishment, although I think it extends beyond the security establishment, for those sorts of relationships, that's really been its strong point for the last several years. This is setting aside, by the way, northern Iraq and the independent Kurdistan region, which has different political dynamics and have been very complicated since its own little civil conflict with Iraq in 2017. But for the rest of Iraq, really, you do have to see this interesting reservoir that doesn't seem to, it has been resilient in spite of the kind of fluctuating of politics and the rise of pro-US, anti-US. And a lot of that, I think, does come from this idea that everybody's trying to walk a tightrope and find a way to satisfy all sides. But it doesn't always translate into affirmative support, and that a lot of these actors, or at least very strong affirmative support, and a lot of these actors feel pressure as it gets put on them to try and find ways to push back, at least symbolically or rhetorically, against the U.S. presence. And it's, again, it's just a sign of the kind of precarious position that the United States is and coalition partners partners are on in Iraq politically. I think a lot of people walk away from the Trump administration's last year experience and say, oh, yeah, the Iraqis are never going to kick us out. We can get away with anything. And I think that's a really, really misinformed take on the amount of political pressure that has been put on Iraqi leaders that would like more robust, if anything, engagement with the U.S. if they had their druthers, but are under real political constraints and in some ways are still finding ways to resist them, but that eventually are going to crack. Because that pressure is going to build to a point where they're no longer going to be able to resist it at some point. Or you have an election, we'll bring somebody in who's not willing to do it.
And where does the Kurdish region fit into this? So you have the broad swath of Iraqi politics being defined by the Sadrists, the sort of Iranian tilt politicians, the American tilt politicians, and the Sunni politicians, who are, of course, have their own, you know, sets of concerns. But then there's this sort of, I don't know, the sort of rogue elephant, right? The Kurdish region, which, you know, of course, is self-governed and, you know, acts quite independent, but also has never formally declared independence and is, or maybe it has sort of, but it functions within the context of a larger Iraq. How is this working at this point, Marcin?
So it's as complicated as the rest of Iraq. I think it just looks better on paper or from a distance. So, I mean, it's, you know, supposedly the Kurdistan region, but it has two separate regions within it that are divided along different political parties. It has its own problems that it's contending with, particularly Turkish attacks onto northern Iraqi territory that it has to deal with. It has, interestingly, very strong ties to Iran, but is usually not called out for them in the same way that South and South Central Iraq is called out for them. I remember very recently I was reading this article. It was about Iranian sellers of carpets selling their carpets in Tok in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. And it was painted as this, you know, very friendly economic exchange between neighboring countries. And that was the way it was framed because it was in the Kurdistan region. But if the same were to happen in Baghdad, it would be, oh, undue influence of Iranians trying to escape sanctions by selling rugs in Iraq. So, like I said, it's just very messy, but there is a lot the U.S. can do there. And I think one of the things that the U.S. should do is promote better dialogue between both the KRG and Baghdad, the Kurdistan Regional Government, but also to promote more conversation between Kurds and the rest of and other Iraqis, because I think we do have to have a national dialogue that is divorced or that is separate from the political dialogue between the political groups as well. So that's just from the societal, you know, bird's eye view of the Kurdistan region. In terms of politics, they have arrangements with Baghdad that are concerned around, you know, getting their money in order to pay their salaries in the Kurdistan region. But frequently there are scuffles between the two about Baghdad's ability to, you know, administer as a federal state resources and be able to, you know, have the central state authority. So there's always going to be these problems. I think one of the reasons they're not being resolved is that the political parties in the Kurdistan region are entrenched. Smaller political parties that are independent, that rise up, really don't get space to operate. And ironically, they might get more space to operate in the central government's parliament than in the parliament in the Kurdistan region. And at the end of the day, I think there just needs to be U.S. push for dialogue rather than the push for treating the Kurdistan region as though it was its own government and its own state, because that ultimately takes away from the sovereignty of Iraq, which is the thing that is most important for security and stability.
I think that's completely spot on. I just to add a little bit about the U.S. dynamic. The U.S. has like a interesting historical relationship with the KRG, in part because, you know, the Kurdistan region in the Hussein era had a degree of autonomy, in part because of no-fly zones. There are now openly acknowledged U.S. intelligence programs that were engaging with the Kurds at various points throughout the 1990s. And so we have a kind of longstanding relationship. And then the U.S. military really built strong relationships with the Kurds, you know, immediately after the invasion and for several years afterwards. And that was due to a number of factors. The Kurds were much more open to the American military presence and kind of more sustainably and longer. The Kurds operated much more effectively as a bloc for many years, despite their own like really, really deep political divisions between the KDP and the PUK, the kind of two dominant parties that really sometimes collaborate to squeeze out any other potential for political voices in ways that people don't acknowledge. You know, the political freedoms in the KRG historically have been in a lot of ways less, perhaps even than the rest of Iraq on a variety of fronts, at least at different particular moments, in part because those two parties are so dominant. And you always saw at the same time, KRG kind of capitalizing on this relationship with the Americans to push their own agenda within Iraq. So you saw KRG troops really be active in, you know, asserting their positions in these disputed territories. That's an argument as whether they should be a part of KRG or part of the rest of Iraq. That's important because they have oil resources and other natural resources. And so there's always this relationship with the United States where we valued the strong relationship with the Kurds. Also, they have very effective, their own military forces, the Peshmerga, it's often called, that are fairly effective and made good partners. During the ISIS conflict, this all really came to a head. The Peshmerga became the tip of the spear in pushing back against ISIS with U.S. And coalition air support. But at the same time, as they pushed ISIS out, they pushed their own borders and military control much further south and west than had been before, and asserted much more control over these disputed internal territories. And that ultimately set the stage for them to threaten to hold a referendum on independence. And that ultimately led to a civil conflict with Iraq in 2017 over the you know, control of these disputed territories and KRG efforts, which are rooted in kind of ambiguous parts of the Iraqi constitution and Iraqi statutes, although questionable how ambiguous they all are, but they have legal arguments for them. But this big debate over who gets to control Iraqi oil exports and resources, the KRG or the central Iraqi government, which in turn has actually been argued in foreign courts as they both try and sell oil. And then the other government often tries to stop the sale of oil, in part because the KRG was working with Turkey to export it at the time. I think still is to some extent, although they have less control over it than they did after 2017 conflict, which you actually saw Iran play a hand in by kind of fracturing the Kurdish coalition to some extent. And also backing with Iranian-backed militias, the central government of Iraq's military efforts moving north. You know, my sense is that the political cohesiveness of the Kurds has fallen apart a bit. They don't operate quite as cohesive a bloc. I think they still do around a lot of national issues, but they're internally, there's been a lot more political discord, and the relationship with the United States has suffered because they thought the United States was going to back them more strongly in that sort of conflict, and they did not. And so all of this has led to a little bit of a messy situation. I don't think the core dynamics have changed that much, but it's not what it was for those who followed Iraq in 2013, 2014, or, you know, might have served there during the big major U.S. diplomatic and military presence. The KRG is a little bit different an actor now than it was then.
Dr. Alshamari, with elections set to take place in October, the Sadrists are aiming to earn at least 100 seats in parliament and even the premier's seat. Which parties and alliances, generally speaking, do you expect to see rise? And is UN supervision likely at this point? So you said earlier that you thought the Sadrists were dreaming about a major increase. What do you expect to see in October vis-a-vis them and the other major factions?
Yeah, so before I answer the question, I'd like to say that I'm a fan of Neil's writing, and I've seen In 1001 Iraqi Thoughts, so it's nice to see a face to a name of a writer that whose work I've read. The question about the Iraqi election. So as I said before, the critical issue here is this going to be another boycott movement like 2018? Because that will change the outcome in some way. Now, I know a lot of people have doubts about the free and fairness of Iraqi elections. And to an extent, those are valid, but they still remain elections that are representative in some capacity. And I think if they were so easily bought or so easily tampered with, you wouldn't see the kind of advertisement and the kind of campaigning that starts so early in anticipation of the elections and the formation of parties and the coalitions and the like. So I just wanted to preface this by saying actually votes matter, and boycotts really did matter in 2018. Boycotts is how we shrunk the pie and gave a bigger piece of it to the Sadrist movement. Boycotts is how we didn't get any big independence as we would have liked. And so one of the things that I had been doing research on is really talking to activists and the protesters about how they think about the elections and whether they would boycott and whether they boycotted in the past. So you get a lot of people who were supportive of boycotts in the past who have changed the way they think about them now and have fortunately, in my opinion, decided that it's worth voting now in order to actually promote independent candidates and to take away some power, make the pie bigger so that even if you get the same share, if even if the Sadrists, as an example, I mean, we keep using them as one of the parties, if they get their share, it won't be so dominant. And I mean, it's honestly not as dominant. It's not the most dominant political group in parliament that we have seen in Iraq's contemporary history. It's over 50, but that's nowhere near what a majority is. So that being said, how will people vote? So on the assumption that there is no boycott movement and the civil activists will push people towards registering new parties and towards voting and towards alliances with existing parties, I think the concern about the Sadrists getting, you know, what they hope to get is overblown simply because they don't have the base to pull it off. And we know this because their base is relatively fixed. We won't expect it to be more than it was in 2018. People are Sadrists. They don't really they're not really growing in their size. They're not attracting more followers. They're a pretty set group. So in that way, that's the part that seems to be the most talked about, but that's the least of a concern to me. And I think the prime minister will get is similar to the prime ministers we've gotten in the past. So it has to be someone who's decided on by a lot of different parties with different ideal candidates. So I don't see the next electoral cycle in Iraq being vastly different from the previous ones. But I also don't see that as necessarily a bad thing. I think if we keep changing prime minister faces, that's something that's actually good. But because we're so caught up in all the difficulties Iraq goes through, we actually don't see that there is in some way progress for having change in the premiership, which you don't really get much else in the region. But the essential bit to add to that is while this is happening, what activists hope is also happening at the same time is the slow rise of independence in parliament, not in any position that can impact huge change, but in a way that accumulates over time, over electoral cycles to genuine change. And so my views on the next Iraqi election is that it won't be dramatically different and it won't really surprise anyone, given that people go out and vote. And even when they don't go out and vote, you can expect that the previous 2018 election will give you a fairly good idea of the parties that have been less affected by the protests in terms of taking away from their base, which is definitely includes the Sadrists. So I hope that answers your question.
So to follow up on that and some of Antti's questions, is there a way to describe what a strong national political structure would look like in Iraq? I mean, this has been the question that everybody's been wondering about since 2003, and I do think in some ways your last point that, you know, there's actually been some significant progress that people don't bother to notice, but we're still a long way from the dream. What is the dream for Iraqi governance? What does a stable resolution to a whole bunch of these tensions look like?
I mean, it's a long way away, but I see the signs of optimism right now. Because when you looked at the protest movement that occurred in 2018 and the kind of rhetoric around it, and it was a protest movement largely driven by Shia youth, by Shia Arab youth. So, you know, the majority of the population in terms of ethno-sectarian identity groups, they were really using a post-sectarian language and more of a nationalistic language. So thinking that this is Iraq's largest group, the young voting class, has an eye on a nationalistic rhetoric, on a post-sectarian rhetoric. You know, in states undergoing transition, particularly ones with ethno-religious fractionalization, it's important for the dominant group to take on the nationalistic agenda and the nationalistic mindset. And I think this is a change that we're seeing in the youth population, and that's a very positive thing. It won't accrue to this dream nationalistic unifying party anytime in the near future, but I think that's perfectly normal. This party would look like one that doesn't have a leaning towards one religion or one sect necessarily, but is tied by an ideology that can be, you know, presumably a nationalist one, but maybe one that's tied to a particular vision for Iraq. And I think that will take some time to build.
All right. We have time for one more question, and it's from Joyce for Scott, and it can be answered in a single word. Tim Kaine has raised issues over last night's airstrike without congressional approval. has the likelihood of a new AUMF increased with the new administration?
It's not a one-word answer.
I think it is.
I think it's
one word, and it's no.
So the answer is it's not clear for the question which AUMF they're talking about. I think there's a very good chance the 2002 AUMF is rescinded, so you will actually have one less AUMF.
You know, we're talking about the 2001. The 2001 AUMF is the workhorse statute here.
It's actually harder.
It's the one that Tim Kaine is obsessed with.
But it's not Actually, Tim Kaine also introduced legislation to revoke 2002. So I actually don't know. And 2002 is the one that the Trump administration at least relied on for the Soleimani strike and for most of their military actions in Iraq, not the 2001 AUMF. So it's actually like a little bit. I don't know. Part of the question is if they rely on a statutory argument, the Biden administration, or which AUMF are they going to do? I suspect 2001 because they have the counter-ISIL mission, which is what they would say this is all about. Self-defense in relation to counter-ISIL mission, but who knows? The part of the problem that the Trump administration had, or not part of the problem, the opportunity is that the Obama administration used some very broad language to describe what the 2002 AUMF authorized, even as they chose not really to rely on it much in any meaningful way. That Trump administration then took that broad language and said, and we're going to use this to do all sorts of weird things in Iraq. But I think the 2002 AUMF is probably dust because of the Trump administration's choice to do that. 2001 AUMF is a harder haul. I am not as pessimistic as you are, Ben, but I still don't know if I'd put my life savings on it.
I am older than you, Scott, and I have
I have seen
talk of repeal of the AUMF and reform of the AUMF wax and wane, and there's this one thing that is always left standing at the end of such debates, and it is the 2001 AUMF. Unamended, unchanged, standing tall, authorizing whatever the heck the incumbent administration feels like doing. We're going to leave it there. Scott Anderson, Marcin Alshamari, thank you for joining us. And Marcin, great to meet you.
Thank you. It was really nice to meet you both.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineers this episode were Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo and Bryce Clem of Lawfare. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our social media manager is you, so tweet about us, share us on Facebook, leave us a rating wherever you found us. The Lawfare Store is where you can get your Lawfare merch and your Lawfare Podcast merch. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.